This is audiobook of To Men of Earth, Including the White Sun's Incident, by Daniel W. Fry. Introduction. To Men of Earth is the account of an unusual visit, which began at the White Sands Missile Proving Ground, near Las Cruces, New Mexico, on July 4, 1950. It happens to be a true historical record of an event which did take place just as described, although that is probably too much to expect the average reader to believe. Fortunately, there is no need for him to do so, since the book, even if considered only as fiction, is fascinating reading, and makes a substantial contribution to the understanding of the subject. It is by no means a new book. The first report, under the title of The White Sands Incident, was published in book form, in June of 1954. Since that time it has gone through 18 printings in the English language, and has been translated into and published in 9 other languages, including Icelandic and Braille. All of this has come about spontaneously, with virtually no effort on the part of the author or the publisher to enlarge its distribution. The public demand for the book, although never at the bestseller level, remains constant, year after year, as edition after edition is distributed. It seems destined to become one of those perennial books that go on for decades, never becoming a bestseller, but never lacking readers. If some of the scientific concepts expressed in the text should appear to be somewhat dated, the reader should remember that it was first written more than 50 years ago. Part 1. From the fathomless depths of the interplanetary void, a deep space transport ship was approaching the Earth. In a softly lighted lounge compartment, two youthful-appearing travelers, a man and a woman, sat facing each other over a small conference table. Between them, on the wall, a silent video screen awaited the electronic impulse that would bring it into action. The young woman was speaking. "I'm sorry there wasn't time to brief you before our departure, but this was not considered essential, since there will be plenty of time for a full explanation of the mission, and of the many problems involved. We have on board all of the video and audio data necessary for such a study, and the material has been organized carefully for simple and orderly presentation." The woman touched a control at the base of the video screen, which instantly came on, showing a complete spiral galaxy. The galaxy approached rapidly on the screen, until one of the spiral wings filled the entire viewing area. Meanwhile, the woman's voice continued. "As you know, the planetary system we are approaching is located on the inner side of this spiral wing of our galaxy. The planet itself has been under occasional observation by passing ships of the Galactic Federation for more than 100 generations, and there are a few records which were made much earlier. It has been of particular interest to some of our anthropologists, because of the race of humanoid beings, similar to ourselves, that is developing there. During the past few generations, our ships have made additional records, and collected more data, whenever their course has taken them within observational range of the planet. With our present observational technology, that would be, of course, anywhere within their solar system." As the young woman continued to speak, the video screen portrayed, in vivid color, each facet of the planet, as she described it. "We have only a small fraction of the total data with us, but I understand that the main library of the Confederation now contains more than 1,000 viewing hours of video and audio records of the planet, as well as samples of its atmosphere, water and soil. There are even a few artifacts, obtained during brief landings, by some of our more intrepid explorers. About 71% of the planet's surface is covered by water, to a considerable depth. While this does limit the land area, the continual evaporation and condensation furnishes ample water for most animal and vegetable needs. The situation is ideal for the development of life forms, both in the water and on the land. As you will see, innumerable varieties of living things are to be found there. The Social Study Patrol Group, which made the first extensive observation of the planet, stated in their report that it seemed as though nature, in a whimsical mood, had chosen this planet as an experimental laboratory, in which to put together organic molecules and protoplasmic cells, in every imaginable pattern and combination, just to see what would result. Among the present group of bio students, there is a growing suspicion that it was not nature or chance alone that brought about this diversity of form. The theory is that some advanced race, unknown to the Confederation, may have used the planet as a proving ground, and that many of the life forms now found there were developed and planted there as a part of some long-term research program. In any case, whether by evolution or by transplant, the humanoid form eventually appeared there, just as it has been found, in various stages of evolution, upon most of the planets that have a suitable environment. One of the most remarkable facts of this particular planet is that the humanoid race can be found there, in all of its earlier stages of development simultaneously. There are races which have not yet achieved the bow and arrow, and whose tools and weapons are still made from stone. At the same time, there are other races which have attained rather remarkable levels of technological ability, including the controlled release and use of energy from the atomic nucleus. As you know, these two points in the evolution of a human race are normally separated by many hundreds of generations, yet, on this planet, they both exist simultaneously, and almost side by side. While the most primitive races have virtually no knowledge of the advanced races are well aware of the existence and condition of the primitives. They now have aircraft which fly to all parts of the planet, and they could, if they chose, easily assist in the development of the primitives. After examining the many critical problems which the advanced races have created for themselves, however, it seems just as well, perhaps, that they do not. Although they possess a rather strong technological instinct, and take considerable pride in their technological achievements, they seem unable to distinguish between scientific knowledge and basic intelligence. There is very little of the latter in evidence among any of the races. While their philosophers constantly extol the virtues of logic and reason, both the people and their governments are still motivated almost entirely by instinct and by their emotions. Most of the people pay lip service to certain high ideals and principles which almost none of them actually practice. They create beautiful structures and artifacts as symbols of their beliefs, but very few have learned to apply their beliefs to the conduct of their daily lives. Their spiritual aspirations remain an ethereal rather than a material manifestation of their progress. They expend a considerable amount of time and effort in their attempts to advance what they describe as their social science, even though they have never made any definite or concerted attempt to determine or to document even the most rudimentary of the rules or laws which are required as a foundation for any science. Most of their leaders tend to formulate their own doctrines concerning the proper attitude and actions of man towards his fellowmen. Each of these doctrines, when published, will attract followers. In some cases the followers may be few, while in other cases, entire nations or races may become eager and devout followers, yet those who follow each leader do so primarily because of the aesthetic or the emotional appeal of the doctrine, rather than because of any tested and proven merit. Thus, throughout the ages, an ever-changing series of more or less random social experiments have been conducted by those whose public position, or political power, has enabled them to influence the thoughts and actions of their neighbors, their nation or their race. Some of these social experiments have been partly or wholly successful, others have been total failures, and some have brought terrible tragedy and destruction to whole races of people. Yet none of these social experiments, successful or otherwise, could contribute significantly to the science of human relationship, because none were designed from, or built upon, any foundation of mutually accepted facts, or even belief. Their social arts can never become a social science until a mutually accepted and documented foundation of basic principles has been established. This is one of the tasks which will be entrusted to you, if you succeed in making the necessary biological adjustments, and become a resident of the planet. As you must realize, however, this will require a rather lengthy preparation. There are a number of obstacles which must be overcome, and many hazards which must be faced. We will discuss these in detail after the preliminary briefing has been completed. Even the most advanced races of the Earth exhibit, among themselves, a considerable degree of paradox. There are remarkably wide differences in the social status and living standards among people who have quite similar degrees of knowledge and ability. Their social and economic systems are tremendously competitive, and those who lead in this competition usually maintain a level of luxury seldom found, even on our most modern craft. Those whose constant struggle barely manages to keep them abreast of the tide, have more modest, but generally satisfactory standards, while those who are thrust aside by the competition, are usually left to eke out their living as best they may, regardless of their intrinsic value or potential. The advance of all phases of technology is pressed with almost feverish enthusiasm, even though that same technology is now producing several very serious threats to their continued existence. Their manufacturing and disposal processes either ignore or deliberately interrupt the normal cycles of ecology, with the result that they are rapidly polluting all of their atmosphere, their land surface, and even their tremendous oceans, upon which they must eventually depend for most of their food requirements, as their constantly increasing population becomes too great to be supported by their relatively small land surface. Even the birds do not soil their nests as badly as Earthman is now soiling his, and, unless the trend can be reversed, he will soon have to leave his planetary nest permanently, and before he is ready. The instinct to kill is still very strong in all of the races of the planet, and almost half of their combined creative ability and technological resources are devoted, in one way or another, to the development and the manufacture of more rapid and efficient means of intimidating, or of killing each other. At least once in each generation, each nation finds an excuse to enter into armed conflict with one or more other nations. Each side is determined to subdue or to destroy the other, and every device or system which their minds can conceive, and their technology can create, is used in some way in the furtherance of this senseless purpose. These periodic acts of tragic nonsense have been performed, almost as a ritual, by every tribe, race and nation, since the beginning of our ancestors' observations, more than 100 generations ago. The leaders attempt to justify these mutual acts of mass slaughter in various ways. They perform some truly amazing feats of moral and philosophical gymnastics, in their determined efforts to convince themselves, and even their victims, that their tremendously destructive acts of passion, brutality and greed, are actually motivated by the highest of ideals and principles. Five of their leading nations have begun to work toward the uncontrolled release of energy from the atomic nucleus. At least two have succeeded, and soon there will be others. The first to succeed, immediately used the new ability as a weapon of mass destruction. It was obvious to our social study group that if another general war occurs, and if these weapons are used, the result will be the total destruction of all technology, the loss of such social order as has been achieved, and the death of the majority of the population of the entire planet. There was a long debate among the members of the Social Service Committee, as to whether this civilization could be saved or whether, indeed, there was anything worth saving. Several suggested that we simply ignore the situation and let nature take its course. It was pointed out that, since the nations and the people were so determined to destroy themselves, by one means or another, perhaps it was only proper to leave them to their own devices until their purpose had been accomplished. Other members reminded us that this race is already preparing to move out into space, and if it should achieve independent and unlimited space travel before it destroys itself, its space-traveling remnants, with their tremendous egos, and their perverted philosophy, might well become a genuine threat to other races, and perhaps to members of the Confederation. It was even suggested that we might quarantine the planet until its self-cleansing was complete. We nodded sagely to these comments, but all of us were wrong and we knew it, and the knowledge frightened us a little. Could the ego philosophy of the race we had been observing and discussing be so contagious that we could be infected simply by observing it? In our hearts, we knew that these races were no worse than dozens which we, and our ancestors have, in times past, assisted on the path to true civilization. From his attitude of close attention and deep concentration, the young man raised his head and spoke for the first time. If the methods of communication and the general knowledge of the Earth peoples is as far advanced as the records indicate, Surely many of them must realize the inevitable results of the things they are doing. The young woman smiled a little wryly, and replied, "Of course they do. And they are very concerned. Each man is looking eagerly to his neighbor, or to his government, to find a remedy that will not cost too much, and will not inconvenience anyone. Meanwhile, they move en masse, toward a common grave, each one complaining that his fate is the result of others' negligence. The planet itself is a very beautiful one, as planets go. It has the most ideal conditions for the development of advanced life forms that we have ever found upon any planet. It is still very young, of course, since its solar system was one of the last to be formed in this galaxy. There is always a small feeling of nostalgia present when one studies the life patterns of humans who still live upon their natal planet. In a strictly primitive way, their lives are somewhat fuller than ours, since the struggle for survival is the basic essence of all life. In our lives, there is very little in the way of struggle, and survival is taken for granted. On our ships, the production and distribution of food is automatic and dependable. The temperature and humidity are always maintained at the optimum level, and even the gravitational force is adjustable to the needs of the moment. Planet dwellers have a wider variety of experience, in some respects, and may enjoy some of the beauties of nature that are not available in space or on our ships. The sight of ocean waves, breaking upon the shore, and the colors of the sunset on a planet, are unknown to us, except when we observe them with one of our long-range scanners. The inhabitants of the Earth must, however, pay a high price for their few advantages. Nature is fickle on a planet, especially a young and relatively unstable one. The surface may erupt, almost without warning, and spew forth mountains of molten lava, burning ash and poisonous gas. Whole cities have been covered, and many thousands of persons have lost their lives in these devastating manifestations of nature. On Earth these are called volcanoes, named after Vulcan, one of their early gods of fire. When unusually heavy rainfall occurs, over land areas, large masses of water accumulate and rush downward toward the sea, overflowing the normal river banks, and sweeping through streets and low-lying areas. Such floods wash away many homes and other buildings, and often bring ruin and destruction to large areas. Earthquakes are a constant hazard to many cities which have been built along and over one of the tremendous cracks in the surface rock layers known as fault lines. The rock layer on either side of the crack tends to move in opposite directions along the crack. The pressure gradually builds up until the rock can no longer withstand the force, and a sudden slippage will occur. The slippage produces a violent shaking motion which can shatter buildings and cause many fires to start in the ruins. The pressure water systems which Earth's city dwellers normally use to control unwanted fires are frequently disrupted by the quake, and the fire, burning unchecked, may consume a large part of the city. Unusually strong winds are another problem that frequently plagues the people of Earth. Circular storms, known as hurricanes, form over oceans and move in toward the shore. The force of the wind raises huge waves and drives them ashore with great speed and irresistible impact. Large numbers of buildings along the seacoast are undermined and swept away. With the many hazards which constantly threaten those who dwell upon a planet, it is not difficult to see why most technological races eventually build their own planetoids, in which life can be much simpler and safer. Some of them would, of course, build their own space dwellings, regardless of the conditions on their planet, because man requires an unlimited environment for successful development and, sooner or later, he will tire of his confinement upon a single tiny planet. The first permanent space dwellings recorded in our history were created by the inhabitants of some of the older planets near the center of the galaxy, about 50,000 generations ago. They had limited capabilities and were relatively slow-moving craft, sometimes requiring several generations to cross the void between two adjacent stars. If a new star was found to have a planetary system, another generation or two might be devoted to the exploration of the planets, before moving on to the next star. Each planetary race which had achieved the ability to build spaceships, built a constantly increasing number of them during each passing generation, and with each generation, more races on other planets acquired the ability to build them. It has been estimated that, during the first 30 generations of spaceflight, the total number of spaceships increased by at least one power of 10 with each generation. The rate of increase tapered off, however, as new technology encouraged the scrapping or rebuilding of older ships. The best estimates presently available indicate that the total number of permanent space dwellings, not including smaller transport ships, is now equal to about the 33rd power of 10. Each ship, regardless of its location, can now establish electromagnetic communication with several other ships in its vicinity, and most items of information and discovery are relayed from ship to ship until they are picked up and recorded by one of the data ships of the Confederation. An individual data bank is maintained for each inhabited planet which has not yet passed the critical point in the social development of its population, so that if there is need of assistance at the critical time, it can quickly be offered by the nearest of the planetary assistance ships. Perhaps it is time that I satisfied your curiosity as to why you were selected as the assistance agent for this particular mission, or perhaps I should say experiment, since its success is far from assured. Since the agent must, in this case, take up residence on the planet, an individual was needed whose body could be adapted to the environment without prohibitive changes, or too extensive waiting period. The minimum physiological requirements for successful adaptation were computed and tabulated. A subsequent scanning of the public service personnel records indicated that your physical characteristics met more of the requirements than those of any other member of the service group. Not very flattering, perhaps, to be chosen because of a close biological resemblance to such a primitive race, but that is not all. In tracing the genealogy of your group, it was discovered that a part of your remote ancestry is traceable to this very planet. These ancestors of yours abandoned the planet almost 1,000 generations ago, after having rendered it totally unfit for human habitation through a nuclear holocaust very similar to that which their descendants are again preparing to launch. 1,000 generations represent a considerable time gap, but most of the biological traits are quite persistent, and it was found that you would require relatively little in the way of physical adjustment to enable you to live there. To be accepted as a native of the planet will, however, be a problem of greater magnitude. It will be necessary to accustom your body to a gravitational force almost twice that which we use in our craft. Your muscular system, and especially the ligaments which support the vital organs, must be strengthened. We must also find a way to supply your system with the trace elements which we acquire from our atmosphere, but which are not present in theirs. You must undergo an extensive program of immunization to the biotics of the planet, which are many and varied, and some forms of which can be quite deadly. All of this will require considerable time, but that time can also be used to study and practice the languages of the Earth, and the history and customs of its people. It will be necessary to establish a direct and continuing contact with at least one member of the Earth race. While we have many records of the spoken and written languages, they were made intermittently, and over a long period of time. Both the idiom and the accent of a language change considerably with time, and if you are to be accepted as an ordinary citizen, your language must be that of today, and not of several generations past. The discovery that you were alien to the planet would, of course, render your position there completely untenable, and result in failure for the entire mission. You will require certain documents of identification if you are to travel about the planet, and also a supply of a medium of exchange known as money. Only an able and cooperative Earthman can arrange these things for you. The establishment of direct contact with a member of the Earth race may be the most delicate, if not the most difficult of all our problems. The individual chosen must be sufficiently intelligent to understand our purpose, self-reliant enough to keep his own counsel regardless of outside pressures, and above all he must be able to consider our suggestions without interposing his own habits, emotions or prior beliefs. This is a combination of characteristics which I fear will not too readily be found among the Earth races, and yet we must be sure the individual chosen does have the necessary qualifications, before any contact is arranged. The viewing screen, which had been continuously illustrating the young woman's dissertation, now became blank as she turned with a small sigh. "That's enough for this session," she said. "It's time for food and rest. Your rest period will be extended over a longer than normal time so that knowledge of the language and such other information as we have available can be transmitted directly to your memory cells, and so eliminate some of the tedious and time-consuming study which would otherwise be necessary. We will impress the data very lightly on your memory, since some of it may now be obsolete, and you may have to unlearn when your Earth contact has been established. You must, however, have a certain minimal knowledge of the language, the history and the customs of the race if you are to communicate successfully with your Earth contact. You will use the name Alan during your stay on Earth, since it is a rather common name there, and is quite similar to your own. If you have occasion to communicate with me, I will answer to the name of Vera, which is also a name common to Earth, and so will attract no attention if overheard." The two arose and made their way to the dining compartment, where they partook sparingly of the variety of tempting foods provided by the ship's automatic synthesizer. Although the transport craft offered various means of enjoyment and relaxation, this was a work trip and, immediately after the meal, Alan and his companion proceeded to the sleeping quarters which, as in most modern spacecraft, was located in the central part of the ship, where the gravity is so small that the sleeper is almost floating in the air during his rest period. Here, the young woman assisted him in adjusting the headpiece of the data transmitter, before seeking her own quarters. The soft drone of the ship had a soothing quality, and Alan drifted into sleep almost at once, having time only for a bit of mild speculation as to what the future might have in store for him. After a period of time which, on Earth, would have been equal to about 10 hours, Alan was awakened by an impulse from the data transmitter. He arose, carefully removed the headpiece of the data transmitter and entered the cleansing room. The necessity of rapid and complete recycling of all material used on a deep space transport prohibits the lavish use of water for bathing, but comfortable and efficient means of cleansing and refreshing the body are provided. On the larger artificial planetoids, however, complete bathing facilities are usually available. After a brief but satisfying meal in the dining section, Alan returned to the small conference room. Vera, his companion and mentor, had arrived some time before, and was ready to continue the preparations for his Earth mission. "We are quite close to our destination," she said, "and we don't have much time for preliminary discussion before the search for a suitable contact begins, although there will, of course, be plenty of time after the contact before you first set foot on the planet itself. You were given a general knowledge of one of the principal languages of the Earth during your rest period, and we should begin to use that language now, so that you will have had some actual practice before you attempt to communicate with any Earthman. We will take a fixed position with respect to the planet, about 900 Earth miles above its surface. But," Alan broke in, "if there has been so much observation, a number of landings, and even a few face-to-face meetings, surely the people of Earth, or at least the more advanced races, must be well aware of this repeated monitoring and, with their rapidly expanding technology, they must have instruments capable of detecting our approach. If the people are still motivated by emotion rather than reason, won't it be rather dangerous to take a fixed position? Our welcome may be a barrage of nuclear weapons." "It is true," Vera replied, "that Earth races are beginning to develop instruments for the detection of approaching objects, at a distance beyond the range of the unaided eye. We do not believe, however, that any they have yet produced are sufficiently sensitive to detect our approach at the distance we have chosen. We could be mistaken in this, but even if our craft should be observed and reported by some space monitoring group, there is very little likelihood that any action will be taken. While it may seem incredible to us, the fact is that the people of Earth, as a whole, are still unaware of any life forms whatever, except those upon their own planet and, while their scientists frequently speculate upon the possibility of extraterrestrial life, their own egos prevent them from recognizing the almost unmistakable evidence of its existence.